I feel that wisdom is bliss because reality is bliss. So being ignorant of reality will not lead to bliss, it leads to suffering.
Welcome to Living with Reality, a podcast featuring archived teachings and modern conversations with Dr. Robert Svoboda, brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Living with Reality explores Ayurveda and other wisdom traditions of India, which Dr. Svoboda has been studying for nearly 50 years. For more information, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Dr. Svoboda. That's DRSVOBODA. Hello and welcome to Living with Reality. I'm Paula Crossfield, your host and Dr. Svoboda's media collaborator. On this week's episode, we have an interview between Dr. Svoboda and Robert Thurman, who you may know as an American Buddhist author and academic who has written, edited, and translated several books on Tibetan Buddhism. In this interview, or conversation maybe, you will hear Dr. Svoboda and Bob Thurman talk about his journey to doing that work, and hopefully you'll be entertained by their conversation. Before we jump in, I just want to let you know that you can get a 50-page ebook written by Dr. Svoboda called Analyzing Karma, Fate, or Free Will for free. Just check out the show notes and you will see a link that will take you there. Or if you found this on the Be Here Now website, you can also find the link there and you will receive this 50-page ebook in your inbox. Thank you so much and enjoy this interview with Bob Thurman.
Professor Thurman, very nice to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert. Please just call me Bob.
Okay. I will definitely do that, Bob. And I want to ask you particularly about the Dalai Lama and his request to you to help bring Tibetan tradition back to India.
Yeah.
But before that, I'd be interested to know a little bit about your own background and, for example, how you and the Dalai Lama came into association in the first place.
Yes, yes. Well, it's a long story, which I'll try to make brief. My own background is just sort of impoverished gentry, both from both sides of civil war, two lineages, and Thurmans are a huge clan. There's M-A-N and M-O-N-D. There's tons of Thurmans, and there's some kind of Anglo something. And I was named Robert after Robert the Devil, who was the illegitimate brother of William the Conqueror, according to my grandfather. So that's so ordinary. And then I went to sort of Anglo schools in New York City. My parents were themselves refugees from the hinterland lineages, for various reasons. My father's mother committed suicide over my paternal grandfather's having an affair with his secretary in the lumberyard that he owned. And she was very religious, apparently, Elizabeth Thurman. I never met her, of course, and I never met the grandfather either. And so my father had, like, left them all there. And then my mother had run away from Wellesley to become an actress, and she was Betty Davis's roommate at theater school in New York City in the 30s. Whoa. And then my father came all unhappy from the family blow-up in North Carolina. And then they had been in love before, but then they just, you know, got together, you know, two of them. And then my mother used to angrily challenge me and my brothers when she was in a bad mood and didn't have an off-Broadway part, that she would have been there with Betty if it wasn't for us kids. And Betty Davis was a family friend. Used to take, she and Gary Merrill, who you may remember, you're old enough to remember
who Gary Merrill was. Yeah.
They used to take us to Jones Beach and stuff. They had a car. Wow. They lived in our neighborhood in Manhattan. Anyway, Betty did it up to some point in her life. So that's my background, a WASP. But I was always restless in the Christian church. although my parents were not religious. And I think my father was a linguist and he loved French. He was a Francophile. He translated François Mauriac's book on Francis of Assisi and things like that. A biography, Les Petits Fleurs, it was called, on by François Mauriac. Mm. And he had a little mystical side, but he wasn't much into church. And my mother was, Shakespeare was God, as far as my mother went. And that's how she ran away from Wellesley, you know. So that was sort of my upbringing. And I liked baby Jesus, but I didn't like the crucifixion focus of Christianity. And I didn't like God because he was always losing his temper and turning people to pillars of salt and flooding and doing all kinds of horrible things. And I never believed in it anyway. I mean, I never believed that one person did the whole thing, you know, no way. And especially because they told me I had to believe because I couldn't understand. And then I always said to that, I remember his name still, Pastor Niebrugge, if I don't understand, that means you don't understand. So, but you do believe, and that's your choice. But you're telling me I have to believe. You don't even know that. So why are you telling me that? Yeah. That doesn't make sense to me. Mm. But on the other hand, the scientific types tell you as well, you can't really understand anything. You just become an expert in this bug, how it crawls over there. Do you know what I mean? You just, and then you know, and then they misunderstand Plato, I think, you know, Socrates, who said he was the... He knew nothing, and yet the oracle said he was the wisest man in Greece, you know. And he did that rhetorically to get other people to give out their nonsense and show them the discrepancies and contradictions in their dogmatic theories. So anyway, I didn't like all of that. And I slowly got involved in sort of alternative things. I was unfortunately really good at math. So, I mean, I never made a mistake, and I did like 10 times advanced beyond what I was supposed to do on those kind of tests. So I got all kinds of advanced credit, and then I lazed off in other things. I wanted to be a poet, and then I didn't even learn what I should have learned. You know, I was very bad at school, very lazy. And then I had fun. I had quite a lot of fun. And I fell in love with a lady who was 8 years older. I was sort of the mini mother, older sister of my schoolmate. And I fell in love with her when I was 11, and she was 18.
Yeah.
And because she was like, I would write troubadour poems about her, and they lived in my neighborhood in New York City, and I would write. And then when I was 17, somehow this actually became a love affair, and then somehow married and got whatever. So I was having fun, too, and... She was a Houston family, French.
Dimenel.
Yeah. And the oldest daughter of that family. Mm. And I thought when she expressed desire to marry, I said, this is silly. I'm a student. I'm penniless. You're from this family. I'm not going to behave like that. And she said, well, you talk to my dad. She says, and I said, we're having fun. Why do you have to do that? And then when I talked to him, he said, oh, I want to keep you. He took me to Maxime's, actually, but he wasn't.
To Maxime's?
He did. Oh, my. And he had helped me make suits at Creed's. You know, it's a tailor in the neighborhood of Maxime in Paris.
Oh, I see.
And he gave me a trust fund of my own to remove my excuse that I couldn't marry his wealthy daughter without her trust fund. So I had my own trust fund, so I wouldn't be having to live off her, he told me. Which I gave back to them. So I was having fun. And she was having fun too because she had been abused by some horrible psychiatrist who shall be unnamed, who had an affair with both sisters, she and her sister, while they were her patients, his patients, really bad character. And he died, and then she met the 17-year-old who had been in love with her since he was 11. So it was very karmic.
It was karmic. Yes,
all her karma.
Sounds very.
We had a beautiful daughter, and a miracle thing happened. Which was when the daughter was born, you know, in those days, none of this natural childbirth and the father being wherever, this is like in the 1960, you know?
Yeah.
And I was down there smoking a cigar and reading, you know, those weird magazines. And he says, you have it, come see your daughter. So I'm walking down the hall and I'm hearing these voices, which I somehow classified in my subliminal brain as PR system, you know, PA system. Mm. And they were calling, Dr. Tara, And they were going, Tara, Dr. Tara. But I added the doctor, I later realized.
Uh-huh.
And because all it was doing was saying, Tara, Tara, these voices like a heavenly choir, which I, not looking for that, never heard of Tara, hadn't even seen Gone with the Wind at that time. But when I walked into the room, I dutifully said to the ex, by that time my wife, I said, let's call her Tara. And she, being French, said, ah, no, les enfants sont tellement cruels. Children are so cruel. When she comes into a classroom later, they'll say, here she comes, Tara, Tara. And they'll ridicule her name. She didn't know the name Tara either. So then I said, okay, how about Taya? And then it became her name. And that was a miracle thing. It was like some goddesses saying Tara. So I think I was being chased by
even
Dharma then. Devas from the beginning, really. And actually, I have remembered Proven Fives, actually, since then. But I had a hard time doing it at first. Then I immediately remembers how many previous wives, really annoying me. In fact, remember when she was the temple dancer in Orissa and her Swedish boyfriend was her husband at that time, so I could be jealous of her in a previous life, of him. But I couldn't remember anything. Then when I went to Kailash, I started remembering former lives. Actually, just the minute I saw Kailash, I had this weird experience where I was getting up from the prostration. There's a place where you come up out of the rise. I don't know if you did. You go? Have you been?
Yes, I did.
You went?
95.
Remember, you come along. 95? That's my first year, too.
Oh.
Amazing. And there's, but I went in October, which was a big mistake.
No, we're in June.
That was intelligent.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at that time. But anyway, so too cold at night in October. Really, anyway, you come up, you come along that riverbed sort of the road, and then you suddenly come to a flat place, and they have all these little cairns. And you can sure see the mountain if it's clear. You know,
yeah.
There's a beautiful vision with a plume of golden sunsetted clouds coming off the peak. It was fabulous. So I bowed like Tibetans do, you know. And as I was coming up, I had the visceral experience of two guys, and I actually knew who they were. One was semi-Tibetan, sort of Mongolian, like Amdo, and one was Tibetan. And they were talking to each other, and they were teasing me. And so they came out of hiding, because they were so moved themselves, seeing through my eyes, Kailash.
Mm.
But they were complaining, of course. And they were saying, we know so much more about Chakra Sambhara Tantra, like, you know, like Mount Kailash, and this turkey who's there coming in, and we can only get him. We never got to go in those days because of all the bandits. And now we get to go coming in a jeep with this, as this turkey from New York. Really? I swear. In Tibetan, they were having this conversation. And it was so visceral that I did have a crick in my neck vertebrae for some days, because I was like trying to see, you know, it was like they were hovering over my head. And then, although I actually spotted them, they disappeared quickly. And I know why, and I can't say where they were, but perhaps there's reasons. I mean, the time of $13, I'm a whole bunch of things I can't say. But I do know, and I'm sure, and then I realized, of course, Dalai Lama must know, and some other people must know. It's hidden from me, actually, normally. And connecting also between Mongolians and Tibetans, something like that. And I had some other experiences since then. But that's when I first started having them. So you know, what I loved, the reason I liked it was not religious, actually. The reason I got into it was the idea that you can understand yourself and you better and the world, and you can be realistic and practical in the world. And the Westerner, no, you can't. You just have to follow authority, you know. You have to understand, that is to say, stand under some authority, you know. It really sucks, rather than adigama, go over into understanding, you know.
Yeah.
So I just loved it. But it's interesting, unlike some of my friends in the Tibetan movement, who their sort of thing was, they were drawn from Montreal or Toronto or wherever it was, or America or Mexico, because they just heard about Dalai Lama or something. They heard his name. I knew some. I read Lama Govinda's a few things, and I was into. Yes. I had read Milarepa, recommended by Henry Miller, actually Milarepa, but it was his biography, but a version of it at that time. But I was very. It was India, and when I would read a Buddhist thing, I would remember Dana Paramita. I wouldn't remember Chimba Paraljimba. You know, now the Tibetan. You know, I would remember the Indian word. So I had some, that's another bunch of laws that I don't really know what they are, but I think I had a lot of Indian laws. And because when I finished and then discovered Sanskrit, I was sort of one to move the Tibetan towards Sanskrit. Although I love the Dalai Lama and I totally appreciate everything they do, but I have this real feeling about India and, you know, the mother country and this kind of thing. I really do. Nina does too, we both do. And then in the systems, I've known them since 62, when they just came out, the Tibetans have been revivifying, in a way, bringing to life all the monuments and the archaeology in India, and that's wonderful. And since the 70s, the Dalai Lama has had a fourth aim in life, which is to restore the full conversation of all the different, subsequently formulated into isms, you know, this and that ism. In India, because he thinks the Indian great masters, he has this poem he writes to the 17 great Pandita Siddhas, Siddha Pandita, who are both Pandita and Siddha.
And Siddhas, yes.
And polymaths, you know, who are mainly associated with Nalanda University, you know. Although people like Bhartahari and Gaudapada, they were in dialogue with all the great, and that turns out Patanjali, they were in dialogue with him from Buddha's time, you know. So anyway, so that was his fourth aim, though. And it was sort of not so well known to people. His three aims being the aim of, as a human, for kindness, just generally, which he sees in all religions, and not wanting to convert and compete among religions for market share, he's been against. He's been telling Christians and Muslims this the whole time, and Hindus and everyone. And then second is world as a Buddhist monk, that their religions are not complete and conflict. Third, as a Tibetan, to speak up for his people who were being genocided by Chinese. Fourth was to somehow revivify India's own sense of Buddha belongs to them, you know. It's always been in his mind.
Right.
And lately he's promoted it to third aim and put the Tibetan one fourth, so it fits more organically and nice, you know. And the thing there is, of course, the irony, the Indians recently, the Indian government, they had this nice institution in Sarnath, and they made it a university finally, but then the Modi group pushed it back to being an institute. I don't know why, but the Tibetans are acting like the best of all possible worlds, but I think it's a step backward. They were, because as the CIHTS, Institute for Higher Tibetan Studies, it was an institute kind of, deemed to be a university. Then it became a university. You know, 20 years ago, and CUTS with a different category of funding from the federal government in India. And then somehow the Modi people put it back to CIHTS. I don't know why. But I think probably, you know, their tendency of Hindutva, you know, overly focused on that.
Yes.
But then it seems that Modi changed that, because then I met Modi, because Lokesh Chandra, when he came to a lecture of mine at the CIIS in Delhi, On the tenure and my having been invested by the Dalai Lama and the Mongolian to start an institution that would translate the whole tenure into English back into the Indian government has had a sort of moderate, very slow, it'll take a millennium to translate back into, restore into Sanskrit some important works. But the whole 4,600 books would take forever at that rate. And so that's why I had that endowment and gave it to Columbia, you know. So I think it's a wonderful thing. It fits with my sense of Indian, you know, when I... Oh, yeah. So how did... I'm sorry, I got so sidetracked because I'm elderly. But I sort of lost that first family because I lost the eye when I was 20. Not long after my daughter was born, I lost the left eye in just an automobile, a garage accident, not a car accident.
Mm.
I could have easily had a lethal car accident because I was reckless, you know, party person and driving madly, motorcycles also. But anyway, it was a garage thing where a tire iron went in my eye when I was messing with a tire. It's just
that happened to one of my cousins, actually.
Oh, really?
Exact same thing.
Really, the prying off the rubber off the rim.
And it just.
But I was having writer's block writing it when I played. I had drunk some wine and I was being careless, like an idiot.
Wow.
Anyway, I lost the eye, and then when I had a weird experience when I was during when I was out, I knew I had never tried any drugs much except alcohol at that point and nicotine, and but I and several days of being unconscious while they removed the nerve and did all the things they did in the hospital. I had this vision, which was really perfect about Western culture. I was in a room of pure mirrors, in which there were all these white busts of all those Western, like, you know, Pythagoras and Voltaire, and, you know, like the, just to show George Rousseau and George Washington and Socrates and whatever, Aeschylus, you know. And they were infinitely replicated in this sort of narrow, but all mirrored in all directions, all these white things. And then swirling around the white things were reddish, green, high energy, like just completely different energy, like swirling around them, especially a green and orange combination that I recognized as the palette of the Hayagriva.
Oh.
Of the Hayagriva Yidam, you know, Ishtadevata, you know. Very high agree with that. And then when I woke from that to be informed that I lost the nerve and everything and so on, I said, bring me Hermann Hesse, you know, bring me, you know, Voyage to the East, bring me my Nietzsche, Also Sprach Zarathustra, I love Nietzsche, and Eric Fromm and Wilhelm Reich and Carl Jung and et cetera. And Wittgenstein, and I'm going to India. I'm going somewhere where they have a yoga of the emotions to understand like how your mind works, you know. I'm sick of this stuff, you know. So then my ex, said, oh, no, we have to, we have a baby. So then I sort of petered out in that determination. But then I was ready for anything. And then when someone showed up with some mescaline, bam, and I died and then came to life in a different world.
Mm.
And then now we're really going to do it. No way not, I said. But then my ex, you know, with her shrink, you know, who had abused her when she was younger, she thought I was just going crazy, didn't want to get, she was too scared to get stoned herself, scared to get an IA. We had plenty of money. I had my trust fund, she had one, you know, get an IA and get a Jeep and go look for gurus, you know. She was not ready. So then I gave everything back to that family and I departed to go to India like a fakir. And I kept enough money to buy a motorcycle in London. And I was going to go to India on a motorcycle. But then when I got to Plaka in Greece, I could feel Asia. And I thought, I better enter on foot. I better be a true fakir, you know. So I sold that and went in fairly, more or less penniless, you know. And then that's when I gave my eye to the Caspian, you know. And I also stupidly used to look at the sun with the one that I had. I used to stare it down. Luckily, it formed some kind of a shield, actually.
Wow.
Where it didn't blind me. Something, some automatic thing where it forms and you see it like an eclipse. Wow. Luckily. I was just really wild, you know. I didn't have acid or mescaline or anything with me, but I was just very determined. And I met lots of Sufis and all kinds of people, and Christian monks in Greece, and the Ahmadiyyas in Pakistan. And then I got to India and started meeting some Swamis and Yogis. But then I met the Tibetans and I was home base, you know.
Mm.
So I knew it was that was what I needed.
Mm.
Saw the Dalai Lama from afar in a big public talk and took a job with Mrs. Beatty, Freda Beatty, Young Lama School in Dalhousie.
Oh.
This was 62.
Wow.
62. And I would teach English and then they would teach me some Tibetan, you know, on my off time. But my job actually was teaching English to them. So I thought that was perfect. And I took it. But then my dad died and of a heart attack. And so my mom found me. But I wouldn't go until she gave me a round trip back to Delhi. Because I left the West. I was not going to touch the West. ever again. Everything I was going to just do, but ever go to cave in the Himalayas, whatever crazy stuff. And then I met New Jersey, the Mongolian guy, who was stopped me in my tracks. I was just meeting him to see, you know, like traveling in Asia, you take a message from this one to that one and make a contact.
Yeah.
But I couldn't walk past him, you know. He was definitely the one beyond whom I could not get.
Mm.
And this still happened, you know. It was really, it was amazing. But I told you a story, I think, the other day. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and here you are now.
Yes.
And I hear that you're writing a book on Tibetan medicine.
Well, yes. Because one thing my Mongolian, this guy, my Mr. Miyagi teacher, insisted when he, because I bugged him all the time in New Jersey once he really turned me on to the Dharma and I had like experiences. I was going to be a lifelong monk for sure. That's all I wanted to do was to have more of them. And he was like, no, you're not going to be a monk. Yeah. I know you're having things. I know you're sincere. I know you're having breakthrough moments you feel and so on. But not only that, he constantly interrupted my meditating.
Yes, I remember you mentioning
he was totally
that.
Like...
Come out to walk his dog at 3 a.m. Exactly. To see what you were doing.
Exactly. Because I think he didn't want me going to some sort of dualistic quiescence mode where I would lose a certain drive, you know, a certain push. I know, I think I've gotten too lengthy. I know, I'm sorry, Paul. You could always edit it. And so you can cut out a lot of that. So that was really good. But anyway, he brought me to the Dalai Lama, and then he introduced me to Dalai Lama under the guise that he was Dalai Lama. He was going to introduce me so then Dalai Lama can decide if I could be a monk or not. But then he told Dalai Lama, don't make him a monk. So then I was very annoyed. And that's why he would never be my guru, he said, because when I do something you don't like, you'll be mad at me, and that's a great sin.
Yes.
So he refused to be my guru. He was totally my guru, though, actually. So then Dalai Lama eventually did make me a monk. But then I was sent to Argentina and this and that. And then finally I got back to America. And then he said, he chased me out a little bit. I said, I want to be a monk and I want to be a geshe, I said, which is the Tibetan-like doctor, you know?
Right.
And then he said to me, the old Mongolian said, do you know anybody who wants a white geshe? And I realized by that time I kind of knew this a little bit more about the Tibetan culture in exile, you know?
Right.
And about the Western culture was they were not, we had no Hare Krishna people at that time. This was still 65,
yes.
You know? 65.
Yeah.
So then different things happened, and finally I resigned as a monk. You know, and then I went to. I was old friends of Alpert and Leary and Metzner.
I believe I heard you were the first Western monk that the Dalai Lama had.
Yeah, I was.
Had
yes, and then ordained. But then sadly I was his first big disappointment.
Oh, I see.
Because I had to resign after a couple of years. You know. And the old Mongolian had proven right, in other words, you know. And I realized that. I had some... And then he sent me off to teach Tim Leary to stop taking drugs and to use Buddhist meditation methods. But then I realized that they didn't want to hear about Buddhist meditation methods from someone who was a fellow acid head, in their view, who must have had a bad trip and therefore went off to become a monk.
Yeah.
And so I had no leverage at all as a monk, which was helping me understand my mission in this country at that time was not to be fulfilled by me being, in the immortal words of my daughter, me appearing to them like a vision of Henry Miller in drag, shaven head and a red dress on.
It's quite an image. Henry Miller in drag.
Oh, Daddy looks like Henry Miller in drag, she says, you know, after she played, remember June, the wife of Henry Miller? She made a movie about
Yes, she was the wife of Henry Miller.
She was reading up on Henry Miller for that part. So that's the thing. So then Dalai Lama forgave me, but I was too poor to go see him right away. Geshe Wangyal wouldn't take back my robes, and I was too poor to go see him, which is a ritual that you're supposed to do to make it a little less of a sin and a disgrace in the Tibetan culture, which in Tibet it would have been a huge disgrace. But once they were all in exile, they were all quitting and they were like resigning and doing things. Mm. So they tried to adapt. You know, they're very resilient people. And eventually he did. He was a little bit quite disappointed for a while, but then he liked Nina a lot. And they particularly liked my eldest son. He had a little bit magical quality. There was some stories I won't go on at length about. But they all really liked him. The Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama's teacher. So he probably is somebody that they know who in the formal life. I don't know who, you know. My eldest son and my daughter and Uma. They really liked Uma. They gave her the Tibetan name, the Bajurakar, Sita Tara. They gave her that name as a child, which we've never used. Somehow Uma stuck. I was reading Kumarasambhava at the time she was born, you know, about Uma.
Yes.
And Uma.
Uma.
May she never suffer. And so then the old Mongolian told me at some stage that my job was to deal with Buddhism as a science. And therefore, my math knowledge and stuff. I learned something. Because when he left me in Dharamsala to sort of apprentice as a monk and learn more from the Dalai Lama and his teachers in 64, he said he also dragged the Dalai Lama's physician, the famous Yishi Dandan.
Yes.
And he said, "You studied Tibetan medicine with this doctor here." And I said, "I don't want to say medicine, I want to attain enlightenment." You know, he says, "Well, you need to understand Tibet if you want to do that. You will only understand it if you learn this medicine, if you learn this four tantras, you know, Tibetan medicine." Really is amazing, too. And it was the first I really knew about the human body. Like, what was I doing with my kidney? Never had a slightest thought about going to all the fancy Harvard, Exeter, or St. Bernard's, like fancy school. Nobody ever mentioned, "Oh, you have kidney and it does this and that."
Yes.
I mean, I wasn't pre-med. I guess they would have told them something.
Probably.
But I was obviously not, I thought of myself as an artist, you know. So that's the thing. And I really think that, you know, those of us who come from the East and were born in the West and then went back and rediscovered what would seem more natural to us and more realistic, and then we're back in the West, that we have like a job of turning the juggernaut of uncontrolled industrialization of the three poisons, you know, the poison of hatred and greed and confusion and
yes.
stupidity and misknowing. I don't like ignorance. I like misknowledge.
Misknowing.
Misknowing. And not just not knowing, but misknowing.
Yes.
And before it wrecks the planet, you know, I think. You know, the sort of the vampire that the sun never sets, you know, and exploit and produce and overproduce and extract and pollute, you know.
It's a terrific karma.
Yes, exactly.
A shared karma by many people. Well, I think the very fact that, you know, that you've studied Tibetan medicine makes you extremely qualified to write a book on Tibetan medicine.
Well, I delayed a long time on that. I did interpret for Yishi Dandan and other Tibetan physicians who would travel, and I evaluated their technique. I used a lecture quite a bit on it. But I was waiting to have someone who was an actual doctor, you know, who could, speak from the point of view where it works, where it doesn't work,
right.
How it fits with the West. Yishi Dandan was very good at that. Actually, he got in a lot of trouble with his teacher, sort of hidebound traditionalist, because he went to the British embassy in Lhasa, which was contrary to the British protestations, they had one, and they recognized Tibet as separate from China, in fact, for a long time. But anyway, he went there and he learned about giving injections and inoculation, and then he was doing heresy, you know, as far as the more straight-laced ones. But he was trying to incorporate modern and Asian thing, and Tibet, the Tibetan medical thing, like Ayurveda, has the ability to have evaluations of things and reduce extremist mechanistic theories in industrial medicine, which, as you know, much better than I, there's a reason for it connecting that could help the problematic areas of industrial medicine.
Where yes, definitely.
Destructive, very much so. And so, you know, so I was waiting. And then I met this Dr. Nida, And he was perfect because he just was, he just is perfect. He's just very brilliant in his own way. And he actually has grew up in China and somehow survived and managed to learn during during the 80s, after the Gang of Four and Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping, when there was kind of a liberal period in Tibet for a little while, because Deng Xiaoping was trying to lure the Dalai Lama to come back. It wasn't genuine in the sense that they still felt they had to try to pretend that it had always been China by either synthesizing the Tibetans or exterminating the Tibetans, one or the other, because the actual presence of the Tibetans makes easy, people instantly understand they're not Chinese.
Yes.
And the Chinese never lived there, and they don't have that they don't have the chemistry to live at that altitude.
They don't have the genes for it.
That's right. So, but they were stubbornly the officials were stubbornly not accepting them.
I only met Dr. Dendon once. I was very impressed with him.
Yeah,
it wasn't because I particularly was unwell. I just wanted to see how he interacted the patient and, you know,
kind of
compare it.
Ashokli Wass in Dharamsala, you went to his place there?
No, it was somewhere. I don't remember where it was.
He might have visited Bombay, for that matter.
It was somewhere.
He received the Padma Shri recently, before he died in his early 90s. He received a. Is there a Tibetan I know of who did receive a Padma Shri?
Oh, the only one?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Because he healed so many.
He healed
Indian
people.
Patients he had. You know. He used to have me read the Indian patients ahead of him in Bhopal's. And tell him my view of it, and then he would correct me ruthlessly. He was a fantastic diagnostician.
I saw him at Nizamuddin. In Nizamuddin, around near Nizamuddin.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he have? I mean, he obviously was familiar with Ayurveda because he lived in India for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Did he have an opinion about how Ayurveda is being practiced in India nowadays?
Yes, well, he thought it was just very similar to Tibetan. They look at the Ashtanga Hridaya.
Yes.
Although the Buddhist imagination of what the Ashtanga Hridaya is a little different, I think, than how it looks in their current set of texts.
Probably.
A little bit different, because they have elements relating to Buddha, you know, rather than Dhanvantari and so on, you know. So much, but the Dhanvantari and the rishis are all there, though, on the other hand.
Right.
And if you know the mandala of Medicine Buddha, he's teaching Ganesha's there, writing things down.
Oh.
And all of them are in the building of the mandala, the palace.
Oh.
And also all the sadhus and rishis, looking like sadhus. And then there are bodhisattvas and Buddhist monks, those are the four assemblies of monks and nuns, you know, the upasaka and upasaki. Those are the four assemblies of the bhikshus and bhikshuni upasaka. And in his mandala, and actually his outside the palace of the mandala, it's in the spa here. The picture of it, the Tibetan painting of it. It's like a whole city. There's many residences and houses and buildings. So I think they think of the, you know, probably the way that some people will call it Tibetan Ayurveda, I think, to make Tibetan medicine legalized in India. I think they kind of adopted a terminology like that.
Uh-huh.
And Tibetans think that Indian is Indian Tibetan Veda, you know. And they both go back to the root of Ashtanga Hridaya, which they think Ashtanga Hridaya is a revelation by Medicine Buddha, is what the way they think about it.
Interesting.
So
You mentioned the three Myrobalans earlier, which, of course, is Trifala.
Okay,
And that would have to have come from India because, possibly have grown
tons
in Tibet.
Of stuff in the Tibetan medical tantras are things that, you know, like things from the sea that you wouldn't have in Tibet.
Yes,
medicines and the different climate things. I mean, there's a lot of similarity. I'm absolutely sure. And I have not read in detail Nagarjuna's books, for example. He has three or four books in the tenure. On medicine and alchemy and also regular medicine and set 100 formulas of medicines. And I'm sure they're going to fit with Ayurvedic stuff, no question. One thing, the Tibetans feel that the urine analysis, the way they do it, comes from the Galenic tradition. They attribute that.
Yes.
And the acupuncture, the way they do it, relates to Chinese, but they have their own acupuncture that they do. They don't do it with a very refined needle all over the place, so much as the Tibetans do.
Right.
I mean, the Tibetans don't, as the Chinese do. You know, but they and the modern Tibetan physician respects this sophistication of Chinese acupuncture. How they have a similar set of points and things, I think. And the Indian points of the Kshatriya, you know, the marmas.
The marma points.
I think those are probably quite similar too, for that matter.
They are. There have been some examinations because, I mean, it really is. It's based on how the prana, the chi, moves around in the body, and there's only so many places where you can actually have an effect on that circulation. This is, of course, for me all very fascinating because I have looked at it things from more of an Ayurvedic perspective. There was one thing you said earlier today that I was particularly interested in, and you were talking about karma as a means of, or as producing an effect of biological evolution.
Oh yes, well I consider karma to be Buddha's Darwinian theory, with having the mind there, and then the difference being that your genes are, of course, there are genes, right? But the genes are create a kind of ur pattern associated with the super subtle consciousness, the citta santana, as they, because they always want to avoid atma, you know.
Yes.
But because of then the projection of a fixed identity there.
Yes.
But on the other hand, so it's always a process, even the super subtle. But that process drags with it, encoded, the tenfold path of kushala, akushala, karma, pata, you know, and unskillful and unskillful, you know. So yes. Maybe tomorrow morning I will try to do it. It's like, in other words, they have us in a different world, and I think Ayurveda does too.
Yes.
Where the mind is very much the most subtle level of energy. It's like the CPU subtle level of energy that directs the coarser energies.
Yes.
Although, as I said, in the very sophisticated Buddhist philosophy, the intersubjective field of minds of us and deities and demons and animals and God knows what else, it's more convenient to address that as if there were this duality of mind and matter. You know, at least on the relative levels, there is a level where maybe you go for non-duality and atoms dissolve, like in Mrs. Kalachakra has no atoms and all this kind of thing. Mm. But that's sort of subtle stuff. And then the sort of general thing, the idea is that it's more convenient to, because, for example, if you, the danger of solipsism, for it's all produced by mind, that's all in my mind, and you're just a phenomenon in my mind, but actually you have your own mind.
Yes.
And you're external to me.
Exactly.
But we're on a continuum of energy, but we're different, so they consider then, therefore, let there be external objects, you know. Although, fascinatingly, the five skandhas, you know, in the skandha, your rupa skandha, which is your material heap as a human being, as an animal, includes your sense fields as well as your sense organs. In other words, you're not just yourself inside your skin. Each of us, all of the visual objects we have around us, even though you and I look at the same wall, my wall is made by my imagination imposing itself on whatever it is out there, the inexpressible, clear light, actually. Clear light on clear light. And yours is different. So we're actually interleaving and interentangled fields, even when we think we're just different skins, running bags of water and skin running around all separated. So even at a totally exoteric level, they have this kind of idea. Which again is a different world, you know, completely different world than somebody who's just I'm here inside the skin, you know.
Yes.
And then I have this fixed identity that's me. I'm a human. I'll never be born as a dog, and I never was, and blah blah blah. So Buddha's thing is like, if Darwin is hated by weirdos in Texas and Arkansas,
and
because it means they are somehow familiarly and scientifically related to black people and monkeys and dogs and cats, and that it's unacceptable to them. They came straight out of a white God.
Yes.
Right?
From out of nowhere.
And a white Jesus who doesn't look like the Pakistani taxi driver that he actually looks like.
That is absolutely correct. How could he be anything other than white?
And so that's Buddha's earlier version of a Darwinian thing, like the chain of being and all this, but including gods and humans, and we've been gods, and we've. But then Buddha has this weird thing. Shakyamuni specifically, they say, Maitreya doesn't quite have, where the human one is right in the middle between suffering and heavenly pleasure, where the human has all the motive and the intellectual equipment and yogic equipment to become a Buddha faster than some more angelic bodhisattva. You know, they have an argument like that. And even a shorter lifespan in Shakyamuni's time, only 100 years or in Maitreya's time, they're going to live 8,000 years or 800 years normally or something like that. More. And then he's born as a Brahmin. He doesn't have to bother with the Kshatriya class so much, like Buddha, because of the violence. You know, he gets to be born as a Kshatriya. You know, they have idea. They have funny ideas like that.
I remember reading once, and I don't remember where it was, but of Padmasambhava wanting to get the skin of someone who had been born 7 times a Brahmin.
Well, they have a horrible thing in Tantra like that. Yes, they do. Not just skin, but the flesh.
Yes, and for they whatever seven, person.
Well, yeah, you eat the flesh of a seven lifetime Brahmin, and then you fly and something like that. Mm-hmm. They have a bunch of books like that. But they don't really go for that, the Tibetans that I know. They know about that. And Westerners jump on that and go crazy and to deride the Tantra and act like they're a bunch of weird, like just like they do with the Native Americans.
Yes,
they're all sacrificing people on pillars. They were barbarous. They were scalping people. Meanwhile, the French trappers started scalping.
Yes,
not the Indians.
Yes,
and then the Indians picked it up as a way of getting a bounty. You know,
right? Well, it as with the creationists, this is it's you it's. It makes it easier for you if you want to get rid of a population to find some way to explain why it's valuable for you to get rid of them.
Pseudo-speciate them.
Yes, precisely.
Yes, indeed. Anthropologists call that pseudo-speciation.
That's a good word, pseudo-speciation. I like that word. It's one more word to be added to our lexicon.
Right. Oh, you know, the thing I want to ask you about
is
the Kalki thing.
Yes.
And what is the messianic, you know, like you have Armageddon, we have the Mahdi, the Muslims, we have the hidden Imam, the Shiites, we have the, different versions of the rapture and weird crazy things in it. But you have the Book of Revelation in the Christianity, and the Mahayana Buddhists have Shambhala from Tantras, and the battle, the final war of Shambhala, and whatever interpretation they have of that. So, and then I know that Vishnu will be Kalki in his 10th incarnation. And I guess, but of course he'll have innumerable incarnations, but there's a specific thing they have. And they plunk Buddha in on the 9th. And what I heard, anyway, is that they plunk him in there and he's sort of trying to get people away from the power of the Vedas. So then Kalki can come and take care of those asuras who have...
That's,
or mlechas or something.
That's one explanation of it, but there are other explanations also. For example, in Jyotish, you have one avatara associated with one planet, and Buddha is naturally associated with Buddha, which is the planet Mercury.
Ah, okay. And just Buddha with one D, and they do associate that
exactly.
With Buddha.
But so Rama is from the solar dynasty, so he's the sun, and Parshurama is from Venus, and Krishna is from the moon, and So that is one reason that Buddha would be, and because Jyotish at a certain period was very prominent and influential, then there would have been reasons for people to accept
it's
Buddha.
It's still quite prominent and influential.
It is still quite prominent and influential.
Nancy Reagan wouldn't breathe an inch without her.
Yes, of course, her astrologer was doing whatever kind of astrology. Jyotish is a very...
Now, Vedic astrology moves a Leo back into Cancer, for example. Like, I got stuck back in Cancer, I was told, which is hard for me, but I'm ready to deal with it.
Yes.
It's more realistic.
But and realistic is kind of where this, and of course, this is a bit on the complicated side from the astronomical point of view, but it's the zodiac is the same for everybody. the Zodiac is the 8 degrees above and 8 degrees below the plane of the ecliptic, which appears to be the celestial horizon for us. And so all the planets move around in that belt.
Okay,
that's the Zodiac. Okay. It's the same all around the world. The question is, where do you put the beginning of the Zodiac?
Right.
So for some types of astrology, like generally speaking, most people who do Jyotish, the 0 degrees of Aries is 180 degrees exactly opposite in the sky from the star Spica, S-P-I-C-A.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it has remained there since the beginning.
Oh, really?
Whereas for, and that's why it's called sidereal, because that means related to the fixed stars.
Okay.
Tropical means literally related to the turning, and it's the turning of the two solstices and the two equinoxes. Yeah, sure. So what happens is for Western astrology, 0 degrees of Aries is defined as the position of the sun at the moment of the vernal equinox in the Northern Hemisphere. And because the Earth is at an angle, and because it's moving around like a spinning top or a dreidel, at this point, it takes about 25,000 years to go around completely.
Mm-hmm.
So every year, it's moving backwards from our perspective. Mm-hmm. From our perspective, it's moving backwards. And so the age of Aquarius is that period of a little over 2,000 years when the equinox is going to, there's going to be a perception that Aquarius is most influential.
I see.
But
Aquarius instead of Aries. That's quite a distance. Pisces is in between.
Exactly. And the age of Pisces is two fish. And so the age of Pisces, one of the reasons, in my opinion, that Jesus is sometimes represented by a fish is because he was inaugurating, more or less, the age of Pisces.
Oh, really? Okay, 2,000 years.
And before that, we had the age of Aries.
Uh-huh.
And Aries, of course, is a goat or a ram. Mm-hmm. And so we had... There was an Egyptian deity, I can't remember the name of it, who was a ram deity. And before that, there was the age of Taurus, the bull.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have there's been some awareness of this for the past few thousand years.
Okay, but therefore...
So what happens is because 0 degrees of Aries is moving back every year...
I see.
There is always going to be a difference between 0 degrees of Aries in the sidereal zodiac and 0 degrees in the tropical zodiac. There are different opinions about exactly how much difference there should be.
I see.
But right at the moment, it's a little bit over 24 degrees. So if you're, let's say your sun is at 26 degrees of Aries, it will go back in the tropical zodiac, it'll go back to about 2-ish degrees of Aries the sidereal zodiac.
I see.
But if it's at 15 degrees of Aries in the tropical zodiac, then it will go backwards into Pisces about 21 degrees or something.
So it moves by 24. It's a 24-degree difference.
At the moment.
So each sign has 30 degrees?
Each sign has 30 degrees.
So that's quite dramatic then.
Yeah, so it takes approximately 72 years to go 1 degree.
I see.
So every 72 years, you're adding an extra degree.
I see.
And that means...
So I'm a Cancer. It freaks me out. But I'm ready to do it.
In about 400 years, that's the time when the equinox is, you know, we're going to get to where there's one entire constellation, one entire sign between the sidereal zodiac and the tropical zodiac.
It's still more 400 years.
Assuming people are still using systems.
That's the time they say Shambhala arrives.
Yes.
So 400 years, which I don't like. I'm very against it.
Well, but and
I know it's written there.
And so there is reason to believe that there may have been some kind of astrological calculation that came up.
Well, that's what they say, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
Yes.
So my argument, and this is the only time Geshe Wangerer ever supported me arguing against a traditionalist, where I said the planet can't take 400 more years of the petropaths.
The planet can. The human beings cannot.
Yeah,
the planet will survive.
The planet has to be.
The planet is going to be fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, because I believe she's working to create a space for humans to evolve to enlightenment. She's working on that's her bodhisattva deed, I decided recently.
But
she's not just a goddess.
She may require there to be, it may be that there are many less humans than there are.
But there might be less.
Yes.
Although, why? Actually, then I know that's what the sort of like Gary Snyder is. There's a certain school of sort of naturalist types today, you know, who are very much into that, you know, that there's too many people and we have less people.
Whether or not there's too many people,
yeah.
As things are going, the systems that are making it possible for people to exist in such numbers are not likely to. They're likely to be breaking. They're going to continue breaking down.
Well, but yeah, that's if everybody's driving three Cadillacs.
Even if they're driving one Cadillac.
But they're electric Cadillacs.
They're electric Cadillacs.
Or they're not driving as much at all.
Right.
They're not running around. They're having to be able to stay in one place.
That's more to the point.
Mentally travel.
That is more to the point, which is what people used to do. They used to astrally travel instead of carrying their bodies around.
So
with
then,
them.
You know, why not have 10 billion people? When you fly around this planet, there's a lot of empty space.
There is a lot of empty space.
If it was all evenly better distributed.
But we are talking about human beings. And human beings are not very sensible overall. So.
I know it's way over time.
But finally.
Yeah.
The final question for you right now.
Oh, okay.
So one starts out.
I don't feel like answering questions. I have so many for you. And I feel you have much greater knowledge in some respects. Although, and I think you'll be excited about some of the things I will share with you that I have learned from others.
Absolutely.
Your knowledge, I totally respect.
Graduate. Always interested in learning more things.
And the way you recite Sanskrit and tell those stories, you're right up there with those different demiurges.
Demiurge, that's a big word, a demiurge.
It is.
Maybe a dimmy, himmy, simmy urge.
I know. My question is,
so, I mean, you are more elderly than I am, which means you're more of an elder than I am.
That is true.
But even at the age of 70, I have to think about the fact that...
So are you exactly 70?
No one is. I just turned 70 in June.
Then you're a snake here, too.
I'm a snake. I am a snake. Congratulations.
Me, too.
Thank you.
That's a very good thing.
It is a good thing.
Tibetan way. I don't know if it, well, you know that's Chinese.
I know is the Chinese thing. And they like dragons better than snakes, but I like snakes.
No, they don't. Well, they do, but the dragon knows needs a snake, which Nina has a hard time agreeing with, but she's a dragon. but she was born same year, but in the January. You know? Dragon is very proud and powerful, but the dragon picks up the little snake and flies around with it. Snake knows where to go better. Snake is the wisest one. And our great danger is vanity.
Vanity.
And miserliness, in case we get stuck on either of those two things. That's our danger. But otherwise, we're very generous and we're very wise.
Yes.
And we know where the treasures are. Supposedly. Yes. I know it, actually. You know, one guy, I met a guy in a cave outside Leer Manasarovar cave, facing Manasarovar.
Oh.
Up on Mikhailov's trip, and he walked in there barefoot. He had no passport. He didn't bother. Chinese didn't bother him and so on.
Wow.
A very cute guy. And he was looking at, he was a palmistry. He had a city of that. And he was looking at some of the people in my group, you know. And we were giving him food and things, you know. He wasn't after anything. But he was looking at it. He looked at my hand and said, you have no money line at all. He said, anything and it hit this hand, it immediately goes. He said, I don't care about you. It's like I tell the other people. And my wife and one of my sons who was with me on that particular trip, oh, yeah, he really got dead. He said, you know, I'm a known extravagant. That's a Leo thing, right? I had thought, you know. But now I find I'm probably a Cancer.
Well,
but that is my homie thing.
There's more, yes, and there's more to the horoscope than just what your sun is doing. There's also probably the moon, and there's also the ascendant.
But that's why I wanted the one you mentioned, the person who knew the time of day people were born.
Right.
Because nobody, my mother never could tell me. I said, what, when, Mom, what time was it? Morning, night, evenings, midnight, what was it? I don't know. Then she launched into a long, tearful description about how she hadn't nursed me, because in 1941, the doctors told her since she was an actress, it would ruin her boobs. And they taped them up, and then she wept because she was feeling flowing and she wanted to nurse me.
Oh, dear.
And then she just went into old trauma. And somehow she, I don't know, I think my birth was such a, I'm the second child, though, so she'd had another one. So already, but somehow she couldn't remember when I was, what time of day I was born.
That's
so people have put it around dawn, a little after dawn.
Around dawn.
Which pleases my vanity, because dawn twilight is the twilight according to the clearlight sort of analogies. Dawn, yes. Twilight particularly.
Yes, the dawn twilight particularly.
And anyway, I don't know. I have no idea. So nobody can know it's my rising sign for sure, you know.
Right.
Some people think it's Sagittarius at the time they pick around the dawn.
Okay.
I guess. I don't really know.
Well, you were born at some point.
I was.
And you will pass on at some point.
I will.
And you will have leave a legacy behind you.
I hope so.
And what legacy would you like to leave behind?
The legacy I would like would be for Western people, white people, actually, because Russians included and so on, and even Ainu in Japan.
Even the Ainu.
Yeah. Even Ainu in Japan. And they get along with their yellow brothers and black brothers and red brothers, you know. And we have a peaceful, beautiful planet. You know, what I love about Kalachakra, Shambhala planet, what I love about Kalachakra is that the couples and deities in Kalachakra are all multiracial.
Mm.
It's a black male and a white female.
Mm.
Actually, use black and yellow interchanging, and white and red, and blue and green interchanging. Those three pairs, every couple is an opposite member of one of those pairs. I don't think there's any one of the couples, even Kalachakra, and she's yellow, she's golden, and he's greenish blue, body, dark, very dark blue.
Mm.
And, for example, a central couple, and all of them are like that. And then Kalachakra has red, white, blue, and then green and blue down below, you know. And the yellow, it has a back in the Samadhi phase, the Ketu phase, the Dunya Dume, the time fire case. It's the only one that makes the fourth state to be a high energy state, high Shakti state, rather than a peaceful, infinite energy state that is inactive, inert in its own way. In its own way. But inert as like just vibrant with power, but not vibrating it. Just totally peaceful because it's all done.
Yeah.
It's all uncreated. It's already happened. It's all fine. And that sort of weird view, you know. Anyway, I know we're way past.
Well, but may your legacy be realized.
Yes,
and accomplished.
That's it. And actually, finally, my final legacy now, at this age of life, is I feel that all people, East and West, are terrorized by their governments, kings and presidents and prime ministers and dictators, and or high priests, in order to make them essential to the people, so that they will protect you from this and that. And then they create projections of the divine as, again, some big protector, but very, like, if you have to follow my rules, then I'll protect it, otherwise I won't. So they project their own judgmental sort of routine, you know, based on a kind of scarcity view of reality, that it's just not enough for everybody in it. And the clear light view of reality, this weird paradox of infinite energy, everything is already done. So it's quiescent. It doesn't need to do anything else. But it can be drawn on endlessly by anybody who perceives any kind of deficiency or any object that perceives a need for energy can draw on this to recover a kind of homeostasis of It's unity. It's in fact actual unity with this infinite energy. You know, like white holes instead of black holes.
Mm.
So that's why I wrote Wisdom is Bliss, the book, because I feel that wisdom is bliss because reality is bliss. So being ignorant of reality will not lead to bliss. It leads to suffering. Knowing reality is bliss. So then I translate the Eightfold Path as realistic worldview and realistic ethic and realistic samadhi.
Mm.
Rather than right and wrong, as yes. if you're following a rule book.
Yes.
And some belief, you know?
Yes.
You're being in tune with reality.
I like realistic better.
Isn't that fun?
Right has always seemed way too moralistic.
Yeah, well, they insist that Buddhism has to be a religion as apart from other religions. And there is an aspect of someone who in the ancient time, farmers and people who are supporting the monastic universities, and they are thinking it's a good thing, so they sort of believe in it, what they're doing. But the goal of the education is to become open-minded and observe what things are beyond your theory and interact with the reality of things, right? So that's my final translation of Tathagata, is the realistic one.
Mm.
Because the suchness of it, that it isn't exactly what your concept says it is, is something always elusive to what you can conceive of it as.
Right.
That's the reality of it. So if you're realistic, you let everything be somehow. That's my idea anyway. So in that legacy, I wish people would cheer up. In fact, yes. The subtitle of one of my desired subtitles, and there are four friendly, fun facts that can change your life. They sort of did that. And they were happy when I switched Noble Truth to friendly, fun fact. I have a reason for that. But my favorite one would be Wisdom is Bliss, subtitle, Cheer the Fuck Up. I'm sorry. Apologize. Bleep.
Well, that's on that why, note, thank you very much, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
And that's why we have to avoid this thing of you criticize the Israeli government and you're anti-Semitic. It's ridiculous since the Arabs are also Semites, you know, but never mind.
Yes,
but
the Arabs are also Semites.
I know, but my point is, I never say Israel did this. And Israel is not bombing. Netanyahu and yes. Ben-Gvir are bombing.
Yes, yes.
Because they're so scared of their own people and going to jail and the Supreme Court. They want to destroy it and they want to just be a happy dictator and yes. run away from the consequences of their stupid actions. Instead of living happily and really protecting their own people. Once they're dictated, they don't want to protect their people. They're scared of them. They want them to do it. And they're so awful situation. So I would say, you know, Netanyahu is doing the bombing. Actually, Netanyahu founded Hamas. He states it publicly 10 years ago. He got the budget to pay more for Hamas by saying, that's how we avoid the two-state solution, my dear friends in the Knesset, because we keep Hamas going. So, I mean, nobody's anti-Israel. Nobody's anti-Palestine. But we don't like the people who want to kill.
Yes.
Instead of working it out somehow, you know. Everybody joining in one tit on the cow, you know.
Yes. Yeah.